Hi, it's Noel.
And Tyler.
A quick note, this is the last episode of Season 1 of Lost Highways from History Colorado.
We'll be back next fall with a new season. And if you haven't already reviewed or rated us on your podcast app, please do. The feedback will help us make Season 2 even better.
If you've enjoyed this first season and want to support us, the best way to do that is to become a member of History Colorado. You can go to historycolorado.org/podcast discount for a great rate and all the benefits that come with it, like tickets to the Georgetown Railroad and free admission to our 8 museums statewide.
Thanks so much for your support.
Lost Highways from History Colorado is made possible by the Sturm Family Foundation, proud supporters of the humanities and the power of storytelling for more than 20 years.
In early 2002, a young Crow Indian named Solomon Little Owl and some other Native American students at the University of Northern Colorado in Greeley formed an intramural basketball team.
We had a Crow, we had a Lakota, we had a Mohawk, we had a Pawnee.
Little Owl was the head of Native American Student Services at the time. He says they weren't very good at basketball, but it was a great way to get the different American Indians on campus together for some fun.
Basketball is really important asset to the reservations, but also Native Americans. I'm sure it's a lot for other different nations or other people, society as well, but we kind of take it to the heart. So we're very competitive. And so in 2000...
When it came time to pick a name for their team, says Little Al, they decided to make a statement, if not a joke.
At the time, almost 50 high schools in Colorado used some variation of a Native American mascot or logo. They had names like the Savages, the Indians, the Warriors, and the Reds.
One of those high schools was just up the road from Greeley in the small town of Eaton. Their mascot was the Fightin' Reds. Here's Peggy Ford Waldo, development curator for the City of Greeley Museum.
So the mascot for the Eaton High School athletic teams is the caricature of a bow-legged Indian brave with a really large nose and a feather sticking out of a headband that's around his forehead.
A small group of protesters had begun to demand that the high school change their mascot.
So Solomon Little Owl and his teammates came up with an idea to support them.
The team decides on the mascot a white guy, a businessman with a white shirt, a tie, clean shaven, clean cut, and so on.
I think it was clip art that we got it from. And he was a clean cut business guy with a tie and a suit jacket and smiling. And
they produced t-shirts, put this logo on their team shirts with the saying, "Everything's gonna be all white."
The Fightin' Whiteys played the whole intramural season without much fanfare.
And then, right before the end of the season, the student newspaper wrote an article about them.
That article led to a local TV news story.
And that's when it hit the national media.
Big question this hour, who are the Fighting Whiteys? What kind of a name is that for a sports team? Well, think about it for a moment. Most of us were brought up with teams named the Redskins and the Braves and the Indians without giving it a second thought. Well, now a group of Native American students from the University of Northern Colorado are protesting a nearby high school's use of the name Fighting Red by naming their own intramural team the Fighting Whiteys.
They were talking about the Fighting Whiteys on CNN.
One night we had CNN, MSNBC, and ABC in my office all wanting to interview me at the same time. MSNBC kicked out CNN and ABC, and it was a sight to see.
Almost overnight, they were famous.
People wanted to be my lawyer, my doctor, my dentist. We got a group of women, I think it was out of Arizona, that wanted to be our cheerleaders, and people were wanting to take me on cruises and on cruise ships. Man, it was just crazy.
And there was a huge demand for their t-shirts. Within the first year, Fightin' Whitey's t-shirts raised more than $100,000 for Native American scholarships at UNC.
All we wanted to do was just share our mascot, but also let the world know that there's representation of Native Americans, in not in just Colorado, but everywhere in America. I wasn't in it for the money, I was just in it to make sure that our message was not twisted.
But the message did get twisted.
White people loved it.
Right-wing talk radio host Rush Limbaugh loved it so much that he plugged the t-shirts on his show. It was a huge success, but nothing changed.
The Eatin' Fightin' Reds went right on being the Eatin' Fightin' Reds.
From History Colorado Studios, this is Lost Highways, dispatches from the shadows of the Rocky Mountains. I'm Tyler Hill.
And I'm Noel Black. On each episode, we explore our home state of Colorado and the American West to uncover overlooked stories we can't believe we'd never heard.
There are still more than 1,000 public high schools across the country that use stereotypes of American Indians as their mascots.
And Colorado is no exception. We still have more than 30 of them.
On this episode, we look at the history of American Indian mascots and the different ways that tribes, teams, governments, and communities have grappled with the controversy.
It's a bright, warm autumn morning at the steps of the Colorado State Capitol. A group of about 40 Northern Arapaho teenagers from the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming are getting ready to run 2 laps around the Gold Dome.
This final symbolic stage marks the end of the Northern Arapaho's part of the 21st Annual Sand Creek Massacre Memorial Healing Run.
For the past week, these students have run sections of the 175-mile route from the site of the Sand Creek Massacre in southeast Colorado to Denver. Normally, the Northern Cheyenne, Northern Arapaho, and the Southern Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes all do this run together over the Thanksgiving weekend to mark the anniversary of the massacre. But this year, the Northern Arapaho decided to make the run earlier.
The annual run was started to commemorate the brutal massacre of Cheyenne and Arapaho Indians camped near Sand Creek in southeast Colorado on November 29, 1864.
Despite the fact that the tribes flew an American flag and raised a white flag of peace and surrender as soon as the attack began, Colonel John Chivington and more than 400 soldiers from the Colorado 3rd Cavalry slaughtered over 200 Native people. 2/3 of them were women and children.
Lee Spoonhunter is the current chairman of the Northern Arapaho tribe. In his remarks afterward, he reminded the small crowd gathered at the Capitol of the real history behind the symbolic run.
I think about the children who were running with their moms because this camp was a lot of mostly elders, chiefs, women and children. I think about these little ones and how their mothers were running for their lives with them and trying to get them to safety, knowing that if they stayed within the camp, they would be murdered.
At the end of the ceremony, run organizer Gail Ridgely invited a stocky Caucasian man with gray hair and a red shirt with an American Indian logo on the chest to the podium.
I'd like to introduce Jeff Rasp, Tardless Hours, just to say a few words here on behalf of our relationship as a partnership.
Thank you, Gail. I have to say our school is honored and humbled to be a partner with the Northern Arapaho tribe. It means everything to us that we're able to share our school and share our land that really is your land. We feel like we're guests on your land. So we do have the Indian as our mascot, and Eugene Ridgely has drawn a very authentic mascot.
Jeff Rasp, whose name all too perfectly describes his voice, is the principal of Strasburg High School.
Strasburg is a small town on the plains just off of Interstate 70, about 40 minutes east of Denver. It's also one of the stops on the Sand Creek Memorial Healing Run.
And it's one of the 50 or so Colorado high schools that used Indians as both their name and their mascot.
And they still do.
Initially, mascots are, I think of them more sort of like emblems or entities that were meant to bring the team good luck, almost kind of like a sort of a sympathetic magic that's translated into the sports realm.
This is Dr. C. Richard King. He's professor of humanities, history, and social sciences at Columbia College in Chicago. And he's been studying the use of American Indian mascots for much of his career. Most recently, he's the author of the book Redskins, Insult and Brand.
Dr. King says the college sports teams began using mascots about 150 years ago. At that time, a mascot could be anything from a totem to an actual person or child, and it could change from one game or season to the next.
I mean, in the early years of intercollegiate athletics and professional sports, you know, mascots were in some ways changeable. I mean, there are schools that would have a mascot just for a period that a particular coach was there, or they would have a mascot and then the students would decide a different mascot was more appropriate, and it would become or has become sort of the fixed image or name of the team. And so
the widespread use of Native American mascots began in the early 20th century. It was shortly after Frederick Jackson Turner declared the American frontier closed in 1892.
It was also around the same time that photographer Edward Curtis began to take highly romanticized portraits of American Indians.
King says the rise of stereotypical images of Native Americans as mascots at this time can be partly explained by what anthropologist Renato Rosaldo calls imperial nostalgia.
Once something is almost gone, once modernity has almost wiped something out, whether that be, you know, the expansion of industrialism or colonialism, people really long to have it back or long for certain aspects of it and want to retain them. And at the exact moment that sports teams are being created, you have Americans who are looking around them and saying something about Native Americans like, wow, they were really wonderful, fantastic people. We should emulate them, or we should take something from them to remember them by.
Of course, it's also about the power and entitlement that comes with having so nearly destroyed Native Americans and their cultures.
Lawrence Baca is a lawyer and Pawnee Indian who spent 32 years working in the Civil Rights Division of the United States Department of Justice. He argued some of the most important American Indian civil rights cases, including Myers and United States v. San Juan County School District, which is considered to be the Native American equivalent of Brown v. Board Education.
Baca grew up in the 1950s and 60s near San Diego in El Cajon, California. The mascot for the El Cajon Braves was a caricature of a dancing Indian called Little Ugg.
Little Ugg is a dancing figure with a tomahawk in one hand. He's got two eagle feathers in his headband, and one of them is broken. Well, if you know much about Indian culture and our use of eagle feathers, you would never dance around with a broken eagle feather. It's a sacred object. It's a religious object. It would be burnt. There would be prayers over it.
Baca and his brothers were the only Native Americans at their high school. The dissonance between their real lives as teenagers in Southern California at the time and the way the culture saw them in the caricatures of Indians greeted them every day when they arrived at school.
In the center of campus, big grassy area where everybody met for lunch, there was this 25-foot-tall carved wooden warrior. He's got a loincloth on, nothing else, hair hanging down his back, a war club sitting on the ground. His arms are crossed in the stoic Indian looking off to the west position.
Baca himself was able to blend in because he wore his hair short, but his younger brother got singled out.
He was kicked off the cross-country team because he grew his hair down to his shoulders, and they said that violates the school regulations. I explained to the school district that he grew his hair long because in our tribe, we wear our hair uncut for religious reasons. The school said, well, we're not telling him he can't practice his religion. We're just telling him he can't participate in after-school sports if he wears his hair past his ears.
Desperate to be part of the school and to feel included, Baca's brother offered to be the Little Ugg mascot at sporting events. But his long hair still prevented him from participating in after-school events.
So instead, the white kid puts on a wig down past his shoulders and a brown face, which my brother already had, and he's the school mascot. That is what I call the personification of irony. When an Indian kid can't be the school mascot, it's an Indian, but a white kid can.
These experiences made Lawrence Baca hyper-aware of the ways that caricatures and romanticized images of his culture were used to cover up and soften what he calls the original sin of America.
The original sin in America is the slaughter and subjugation of American Indians. American Indians were being slaughtered and their land stolen for 150 years before the first slave was brought over. Slavery was ugly, it was nasty, it was bad, it was vile, but it wasn't the original sin.
Quite simply, says Baca, Americans haven't come to terms with the fact that their country is built on stolen land nearly cleared of its original inhabitants in a centuries-long campaign of genocide.
Psychologists will tell you, you couple that with the concept of defeat and ownership. We own you, therefore we own your image. We get to glorify your image because we're embarrassed by what we did to you 200 and 300 years ago. And so we then create all of this fantasy around certain native images. And then, as I say to audiences, we use Indian imagery to sell products to white folks.
The magnitude of this sin can be measured in some ways, says Baca, in the sheer number of products that have used Native American imagery.
His extensive collection of everything from Land O'Lakes butter, Calumet baking soda, and American Spirit cigarette packages is now at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian.
Just walk down the aisles in your nearest grocery store and you'll still spot half a dozen on the shelves.
And you'll see products like Aunt Jemima pancake mix and syrup, cream of wheat, and others that trade on African-American stereotypes.
But it's mascots for sports teams, says Baca, that really magnify the extent of the problem where Native Americans are concerned.
We get told as Native people all the time that everything from the Washington Football Club to Chief Wahoo honors Indian people. Well, I will tell you how we know above all else that it is not an honor. Because there is no other race coming forward and saying, why is it always the Indians? Why aren't you mocking my race and culture at halftime? You don't have African Americans, Asian Americans, Hispanics coming forward and saying, why is it only them that gets honored by having caricatures about them and racial pejoratives used to name your teams? If it were an honor, all of those groups would be standing up and saying, we want it too, but they don't want it. We got it. We'd like to give it away because we'd like to get rid of it. But nobody comes up and says, I want to be honored in that same fashion.
Some critics also point out examples like the Notre Dame University Fighting Irish. They use a caricature of a leprechaun as their logo and mascot, which could be considered offensive by some.
Okay, you're Irish and you're offended by it. Have you ever called the chancellor of the school and said, I'm Irish and I'm offended? Have you ever written them a letter and said, I'm Irish and I'm offended? Have you ever gone to the stadium and carried a sign that said, I am not a little leprechaun, I am a human? Because if you do that, I can get 200 Indian people who'll stand there with you with a sign because we know how it feels. But the reality is you've said no to me each of those times because you're not offended by it. And then, of course, the secondary argument is, the Fighting Irish of Notre Dame is self-identification. It's a group of people who perceive themselves as being of Irish heritage, and they chose Fighting Irish as something to be proud of.
Support for History Colorado comes from the Coors Brewing Company. Coors is proud to sponsor Beer Here, Brewing the New West, now on view at the History Colorado Center in Denver. The exhibition features artifacts and insights that reveal why Coloradans today enjoy 360 breweries and counting. More than just a tale of ale, Beer Here is a story of Colorado, told over a few beers.
There are currently 5 professional teams that use Native American names or mascots.
Though the Cleveland Indians dropped their Chief Wahoo mascot just this past season, there are still the Atlanta Braves, the Chicago Blackhawks, the Kansas City Chiefs, and the football team from Washington whose name many won't even say.
I call it the R word because I compare it to the N word all the time. And of course, I'm known for using both words when I speak to audiences. I don't say R word or N word. I say the words flat out because I want the audience to feel the punch of the word and say to them, when a black person hears the N-word spoken completely, that's how an American Indian hears Redskin.
The team from Washington was originally from Boston, says Lawrence Baca.
At first, they were the Boston Braves.
As Team Lore would have fans believe, they soon changed their name to honor a Native American coach and 4 Native American players. But it was always something of a lie, says Baca.
They named the team the Redskins because they had an American Indian coach named Lone Star Dietz. Well, Lone Star Dietz wasn't an Indian. Now, he led his whole life claiming he was, and so maybe the team believed that he was. But the fact is, he was a fraud. He was a white guy passing himself off as an Indian. But then the team moved to Washington, D.C.
By the time they moved to the nation's capital in 1937, the name had already stuck.
Then, 30 years later, protests and demands to change the name began as part of the civil rights movement, says C. Richard King.
So, activism around and questioning mascots really begins in the late 1960s in association with a broader resurgence of Native American political, intellectual, and cultural life and activity, right? This is the same time period that African Americans are saying, why is there a restaurant called Sambo's in the United States? You know, why is Aunt Jemima still in a pancake box?
But protests against Native mascots in professional sports have had little effect.
You know, the Washington football team has been the subject of protests for 50 years, and there's been really no change other than the rhetoric and the tactics that various owners have taken in an effort to deflect the critique and deny the assertions of the activists. And so I think that contrast is really important to note, is that there's been...
Further complicating the matter, some polls have found levels of support for Native mascots among Native Americans. But these polls typically survey anyone who self-identifies as having Native ancestry rather than actual enrolled tribal citizens.
Critics argue that many of the respondents who like the mascots have no real stakes where discrimination is concerned.
In a series of legal challenges, the Washington team's trademark was revoked on the grounds that it was disparaging to Native Americans under a 1946 trademark law called the Lanham Act.
But the case was ultimately overturned in 2017 when an Asian American band ironically named the Slants challenged the Lanham Act under the First Amendment.
And so the team from Washington kept their name and their logo. Getting rid of Native American mascots at the collegiate and high school levels has been far more successful, says C. Richard King.
Right. So, you know, someplace like Marquette or Stanford or the University of Oklahoma, those places have all made changes and in some ways made changes rather quickly in response to concerns from Native American students and citizens.
In 2005, the NCAA announced sanctions against any team that continued to use a mascot deemed, quote, hostile or abusive to Native Americans.
Teams with American Indian mascots were required to either secure an explicit endorsement of their logo and mascot from local tribes or to change their mascot.
The University of Illinois and University of North Dakota, for example, were unable to find tribes to endorse them. The Florida State University was able to get an endorsement from the Florida tribe of the Florida Seminole tribe.
Despite the endorsement from Seminole tribes in Florida, the mascot remains problematic. Oklahoma Seminole tribes never gave their endorsement. Then there's the issue of the actor who plays the chief, Osceola. He rides an Appaloosa horse to the center of the field to drive a flaming spear into the turf to get fans fired up for the game. But he's played by a white actor in dark makeup.
C. Richard King says that beyond those concerns, one of the biggest problems is that fans of opposing teams don't often share the respect for the tribes that their fans at home might have.
You know, for their homecoming, they're playing a team with an Indian mascot, and they'll have banners up like, you know, welcome to the second trail of tears or something like that. You know, and to me, it's clear that obviously the opposing fans have not shifted at all in terms of how they're thinking about Indians and Indianness, which begs a bigger question to be thought of. It's like local change is really important, but what happens when local change travels?
The Utah Utes have what may be the most successful example of a tribal endorsement in the NCAA. They had already dropped their Runnin' Redskins nickname all the way back in 1972 in favor of Utes. Then, after the NCAA forced them to get tribal endorsement in 2005, they quickly changed their mascot to an eagle named Swoop, but kept their name and added a Ute tribal flag to their football helmets with Ute endorsement.
They also kept their logo. It's a circle with feathers attached, meant to symbolize a drum with a large red U in the middle.
Beyond that, the university has gone to great lengths to make sure that fans don't disrespect the Ute tribe at sporting events.
Everyone attending Ute home games gets a pamphlet. It clearly outlines acceptable behavior and warns against racial slurs, war paint, feathers, headdresses, and other American Indian symbols, chants, or demeaning signs that play on stereotypes.
They don't just do it one time a year, they do it every time. And so the stuff that you, that ridiculous stuff that you hear at Florida State and, you know, chants at the Kansas City Chiefs games and Atlanta Braves, the hump, tomahawk chop, it's not allowed anymore. They don't do it there in Utah.
This is Darius Smith.
I'm the director of the Denver Anti-Discrimination Office, and I also provide staff. I'm the staff liaison to the Denver African-American Commission as well as the Denver American Indian Commission. I'm Navajo on my mother's side and African-American on my father's side.
Smith believes the University of Utah handled the NCAA crackdown as well as any school could, short of changing the mascot altogether.
But in this brochure, they also give information about the tribes and their state. Not just the Utes, but, you know, my tribe also is in the state of Utah, the Navajo, the Paiute, the Shoshone, and the Goshute. And basically, it's an acknowledgement and showing that Natives are contemporary contributors to the state of Utah, and it's a beautiful thing. I'm all for it.
In 2014, John Hickenlooper became the first Colorado governor to publicly apologize for the state's role in the Sand Creek Massacre.
Today we gather here to formally acknowledge what happened, the massacre at Sand Creek. And we should not be afraid to criticize and condemn that which is inexcusable. So I'm here to offer something that has been too long in coming. And on behalf of the state of Colorado, I want to apologize.
For American Indians like the Ute, Cheyenne, Arapaho, and Navajo in Colorado at the time, it looked like many issues that had gone largely unaddressed for years might finally begin to change.
Among those issues was the fact that in 2015, there were still more than 30 K-12 schools in Colorado that used some version of Native American names, mascots, and logos.
There was already legislation that had been proposed by then Representative Joe Salazar and others prior to him who were looking at running state legislation to make it illegal for the use of Native American mascots.
This is Ernest House Jr.
I'm a member of the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe from southwestern Colorado, and I'm a senior policy director for the Keystone Policy Center, along with being the director for the American Indian Alaska Native Program there at the Keystone Policy Center.
House also comes from a family of Washington football fans, which complicates his perspective and feelings about American Indian mascots.
At the time of the legislation, House was the executive director for the Colorado Commission of Indian Affairs. When the legislation to make Indian mascots illegal failed, he began to look for other solutions.
House had followed the national and collegiate mascot controversies. Short of legislation or a mandate, he wondered how they could get schools to change.
I brought that back to our lieutenant governor then at the time, Joe Garcia, and our staff, and we thought about a way to really increase and engage in a dialogue. And how could we educate folks, maybe taking a step back, getting that perspective?
Some schools like Arvada, Montbello, and Arapaho high schools in Denver had already either changed their mascot or worked to redesign their logo and mascots and build relationships with the tribes.
It followed logically that if more schools were going to change, then they'd need to be educated too.
So on October 5th, 2015, Governor John Hickenlooper signed an executive order creating the Governor's Commission to Study American Indian Representations in Public Schools.
The commission was formed to, quote, facilitate discussion around the use of American Indian imagery and names used by institutions of public education.
The only objectives going in were education and dialogue.
I hadn't seen this type of approach very often by anybody else. It was a longer approach. It might have been easier just to try to focus on state legislation, but it seemed like what we were missing here was that key education and who I had heard Darius give these presentations, but I'm also an American Indian. I talk with him and visit with him regularly. But I also taken a step back going, wow, there's probably a lot of people who don't know yours and others' history.
The commission was comprised of 16 people, including Darius Smith, various tribal members from around the state, educators, and students.
One of those students was a young woman named Lindsay Nichols from Strasburg High School in eastern Colorado.
I'm Lindsay Nichols. I'm a senior at CU Boulder. So I actually started this project 4 years ago, my senior year of high school at Strasburg. And I really got involved, I think it started at an early age because I was really interested in Native American history, culture. I used to go to the library the town over because we don't have a library in Strasburg. So I used to go to the library of town over and just check out books on Native American culture and history.
When Nichols got to high school, she was surprised not only by how little her friends knew about Native American history, but how little was taught in school.
And so I really wanted to see change, not only like the curriculum, but also since our school is the literal Strasburg Indians, I thought that we should be learning way more about the people who used to live in Strasburg and who were first in America in general.
Nichols also played sports, and she began to notice the way rival schools' mascots portrayed American Indians.
We used to play teams in sports like Lamar, and they're the Savages. We used to play Eaton, and they're the Reds. And I remember comparing what we had in our school on our gym floor, on our walls, on our jerseys, to what those schools had. And I remember seeing a disconnect because they had more of a caricature, and, you know, the word Savages in general is terrible to describe a group of people. And so I really noticed it more with other schools first, but then that made me kind of have this introspective of like, wait, well, is Indian even respectful? Like, are the way we're portraying these people even respectful?
With the help of Principal Jeff Rasp, Nichols began to reach out to tribal leaders of both the Cheyenne and Arapaho, the tribes that inhabited the place that's now called Strasburg before American settlers arrived.
At that exact time, Ernest House Jr. was just beginning to assemble the governor's commission.
It wasn't long before word about Strasburg got back to him. He asked Nichols and Principal Rasp to join the commission.
In turn, Strasburg also volunteered to be one of the four communities the commission visited to discuss changing their mascot.
The only criteria for visiting communities were that they had to have a Native American name, logo, or mascot, and
The commission actually, the very beginning, said that they weren't going to go to any community that didn't want them there. And I think that was really important. I mean, there needed to be clearly respect. There was going to be a lot of emotional testimony, the way that these meetings were structured.
The communities that invited the commission were
Strasburg, Colorado, which Strasburg Indians, Loveland, Colorado, which were the Loveland Indians, Eaton, Colorado, which were the Eaton Reds, and Lamar, Colorado, which were the Lamar Savages.
Loveland had already begun having conversations with a tribe in the Dakotas when they asked the commission to visit.
And Eaton High School, where the Fightin' Whiteys had staged their protest 10 years earlier, didn't invite the commission to come. The members of the student newspaper, Red Ink, did.
Eaton has only recently stopped using their Indian mascot, which looked almost exactly like Chief Wahoo, the mascot of the Cleveland Indians baseball team.
Perhaps ironically, the community least receptive to change was Lamar, Colorado, whose mascot is the Savages. Still, they invited the commission to come.
Lamar is just a 45-minute drive from the Sand Creek Massacre site near the Kansas border.
Ernest House Jr. went in with an open mind.
It was just to try to gain an understanding of why they still have this mascot, why they still refer to not just the term Savages, but link the name, the term Savages to American Indians and have that as an ongoing mascot.
Lamar's logo looks like something out of a 1950s Lone Ranger comic. Unlike some logos that use profiles of American Indian caricatures, theirs is a frontal view of a menacing face in a headdress. And many other schools across the country, says Ernest House Jr., use the same image.
It's clip art and it's easy to get. And I think that's why a lot of the other schools use the easy to get clip art, because you really don't have to you just select from what's already been used out there and or what's available, and that's the easiest to get to.
Not only is it clip art, which is free, it's old clip art that plays on stereotypes. This is what the commission wanted to help the schools it visited understand.
For one thing, not all tribes wear headdresses, and such depictions tend to homogenize Native Americans into a singular monolith when in fact...
You know, you have over 570 federally recognized tribes today, a lot more 150, 200 years ago, right? And all of our indigenous cultures had our own name for ourselves. I'm a member of the Ute tribe. Ute's not a name we gave ourselves. It's a Spanish, what the Spanish explorers gave us. We call ourselves Nutu, but the first written document of Spanish exploration prior to the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo referenced us as Utahs, and then that translated into Utes, and then now it's what we go by Utes today.
Such clip art images that reinforce European perspectives also perpetuate the notion that Native Americans only live in the past, says House.
I think my experience in terms of being a member of the Ute Mountain Reservation or a member of the Ute tribe, the longest, oldest continuous residence of what we know as the state of Colorado, but then also running into folks who have never heard of Utes, who don't realize we're still around, that we still exist, that what we've been here around 8, 10 to 12,000 years of what we know what is now Colorado. And so I think it's just part of that ongoing education effort. And so for me, it was more of educating myself. And I think it's also that education process of a lot of that historical context. You know, nationally, American Indians make up 2% of the U.S. population.
Ernest House Jr., Darius Smith, and Lindsay Nichols all remember how uncomfortable the commission meeting in Lamar felt. The school superintendent had recommended police presence. Some Lamar residents were already upset about the proposed legislation to do away with all American Indian mascots across the state.
Many who came out that night wore their Lamar Savages letter jackets, hats, shirts, and jerseys in support of the mascot.
Darius Smith gave his presentation. It's a PowerPoint that outlines the many ways that racist images and stereotypes hurt not only American Indians, but prevent non-natives from having more meaningful relationships with living tribe members.
After the presentation, they opened up the discussion with the audience.
I remember now there was a person that stood up and said, "I'm a savage. He's a savage. He's a savage." And they're pointing to people that went to high school there, that live in the community. And it was, I think, just of all of the mascots out there in the state of Colorado, that one's probably the most offensive one. And I think the people on the panel, I'm looking up and I'm like, wow, this is weird. It's weird to hear this. And so I think it was the actual, just the repeating of, "I'm a savage." And there was actually some people stood up and said, before they started, "I consider myself a savage."
Lindsay Nichols remembers how hard it was to reconcile that negative stereotype of the savages with the positive feelings of community identity people in Lamar felt it gave them.
I think a lot of them had that mentality of, like, you're coming in here and you're trying to take away everything that we've built. And for some reason, they, like, correlate their experience in that school with a mascot. It's just part of their pride, I guess, and just part of their own personal history.
We reached out to Lamar High School principal Greg Eddy for comment.
Message. One.
Hi, this is Greg Eddy, the principal of Lamar High School, and I just was leaving a message. I did get your message for the podcast you're looking at doing, and I don't believe that we'd be interested in participating, but thank you for the phone call. Have a good day. Bye.
And Lamar High School Superintendent Dave Tecklenburg didn't return our calls.
Ultimately, after Lamar invited the commission to give their presentation and hold a conversation with the community, they decided not to change their name or their mascot.
Support for History Colorado comes from Colorado State University. CSU embraces the critical role that History Colorado plays in preserving and telling the stories of our state and the West. As Colorado's land-grant university, CSU is proud to be a partner in programming and outreach statewide. As they celebrate 150 years of education, research, and service, CSU remains committed to preserving the past and creating a brighter future. Learn more at colostate.edu.
Strasburg, Colorado, which is even smaller than Lamar, welcomed the Governor's Commission to Study American Indian Representation in Public Schools with little community resistance.
Lindsay Nichols, who was a senior at Strasburg at the time, had already been educating friends and members of the community about issues around Native mascots and the history of the tribes in the region when the commission first came to visit.
And so a lot of people were super supportive and knew who I was. I basically knew every single person who was there. So that was a completely different dynamic.
Principal Jeff Rasp had also supported Nichols from the beginning.
It was a topic that was kind of near to her heart about studying the mascot and studying the origins. And right up, it was almost a perfect storm right about the same time that she came to me and we were starting to do some research on it. The bill that was going to the legislature to ban mascots came to our attention. In fact, one of our school board members went down.
Changing their mascot and logo met with very little pushback, says Rasp.
And then over the course of that first year that Lindsay was in charge of it, we established this fantastic partnership with the Northern Arapaho tribe, and one of their leaders, one of their elders, Eugene Ridgely, designed a new mascot for us. Anyway, so that was, we knew at that point we had their blessing, and we used that depiction ever since. And then we eliminated any of the other symbols that that might have been out there. We didn't have a consistent symbol until then, including for athletics using an S, and the symbol that Eugene Ridgely drew has largely been on almost everything else, including a lot of our academics and stationery and things like that.
Changing the logo was a symbolic gesture, but it quickly opened the doors to build more meaningful, long-term relationships, says Nichols.
The major relationships that I built were with the Ridgely brothers, who were three Northern Arapaho brothers. My parents and I went up to the Wind River Reservation and spent some time with them, and they took us to their school and their casinos up there and just kind of showed us around. And I had no idea what to anticipate with talking to these tribal members. Like, would I be terrified? Would they hate me? Would they tell me that this was never going to work and that it was so disrespectful? And I think the Ridgelys kind of surpassed all those expectations for me because they were just so kind and so welcoming. And they were more like, well, what do you guys want to do with your school and how can we help you and how can we support you? And it was like completely reversed of what I had expected.
For Principal Rasp, education and awareness had been the biggest benefit of changing their logo.
One of the major changes, I think, just the fact that we were used our partnership or this have benefited so much from the partnership with the tribe has been, to me, the biggest thing. We educate our students on the history of the Arapaho and Cheyenne, particularly Arapaho. We bring them to our school at least once a year to do a major powwow with our students. We've done it ever since Lindsay was here.
Okay, good morning there, Strasburg. Did I say that right? Strasburg, oh, yeah. I said good morning. We can do better than that. Good morning. There we go.
And then students, last few years from the tribe, we've had our students meet with them and they've talked about their life and their culture. And we educate all the kids starting in about seventh or eighth grade all the way through high school about the history, and we talk a lot about the Sand Creek Massacre and how that impacted, obviously, the Arapaho and Cheyenne and our mistreatment of them over centuries. We want our students to be aware of how our country has not treated them well and that we own some of that.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here come the Indians.
When we talked to students and faculty of the Strasburg homecoming football game this fall, there was nothing but support, not only for the logo and mascot change, but for the relationship with the Northern Arapaho.
Here's Cliff Smith. He graduated from Strasburg High School in 1974 and now teaches history there. He says the relationship with the Northern Arapaho has allowed him to teach a richer, more complicated version of American history that connects to the present.
Because this land was owned by the Native American peoples. And, you know, when the white man came in here, they took it. That's all there is to it. And that's what happened to most of the West. And so I think that's why it's important to kids, too. They look at this and they see where our part is in this. And what can we do to to rectify some of that? Well, we need to show respect to those cultures. And I think that's where a lot of this, the respect from these students come from. And they were here in this classroom. You know, they were actually physically here. So I think that's a huge part of that.
The Strasburg students who've continued Lindsay Nichols' work with the Northern Arapaho feel just as fortunate to have a more meaningful relationship with both the past and the present of the land they live on.
Here are Maddie Douglas, Victoria Mariano, and Amity Howard.
Well, personally, I don't like Native American mascots. I think they're degrading and wrong almost. But I think this is the best way to do it because I've had opportunities that no other school has, and like we've met all these wonderful people, and like we have the opportunity of having them come down talking to their students. And so even though I don't agree with it, I feel that being a part of this makes it more respectful.
I think it's impacted me a lot in the way that I look at people around me that I don't know what their backstory is or what they've been through or their culture. Really taught me a lot about the importance of learning about other cultures, because that ensures that people aren't respected around you. So I'll definitely always be thinking about that in everywhere I go.
I went to an internship last week. It was a variety of schools, but they kind of asked about Strasburg and what are some of the things we stand for and show. So I actually got to teach about 50 some kids about that and kind of explain what and why we're called the Indians and what we're doing to like continue our partnership with that. So that was one of the main ways, and it was really cool to be able to tell all of them about that.
And we want to move forward and continue to be partners long into the future. It means everything to us. So thank you.
Thank you. Back at the Capitol in Denver, we spoke with the students and runners from the Northern Arapaho tribe after the Sand Creek Memorial Healing Run. We asked them about their thoughts on Strasburg's mascot.
Here are Hunter Lone Dog, Darian Bereza, and Ziana Hubbard.
And I feel they have a lot of respect for us, so I ain't gonna trip over that, over just a mascot or anything. I mean, they show love to us, so we gotta show love back.
I feel like they give us more respect than that because they represent and they show us respect about it. But like most, like if other people would like disrespect us about it, you know, it wouldn't be a good thing, but if they're just respecting us like that and showing us love that we came there, it'd be a good thing.
Strasburg, it's really important because everyone there, they really want to learn what happened, and I really like that.
We also spoke with Lee Spoonhunter. Again, he's chairman of the Northern Arapaho. We asked him what he thought schools like Lamar were missing out on by not updating or changing their mascots and building relationships with the tribes.
And what they missed out on is a very good friendship with tribal people, and that they don't learn the rich history and the heritage and what our ancestors had to go through, and to be strong and to be resilient and to teach us how to live today. I think there's just a lot of education and a good fellowship and friendship that they're missing out on.
For Governor Hickenlooper's commission to study American Indian representations in public schools, Strasburg High School's handling of their Indian mascot was, in many ways, an even better outcome than they could have hoped for, even if they'd changed their logo and mascot altogether.
Again, here's Ernest House Jr., the former executive director of the Colorado Commission on Indian Affairs.
Strasburg was just complete. I mean, I'd use them as an example across the board of how the goodness that could come out of this conversation. A prime example of now, not only are they using that image respectfully and with the tribe's consent, but they're also teaching American Indian history in their school. And that's a win-win across the board.
There's no question that many positive relationships have been built from reimagining mascots like the Strasburg Indians and the Utah Utes.
Still, some American Indian activists and scholars believe that such compromises simply aren't enough, and they have research to back up their claims.
Dr. Stephanie Freiberg is professor of psychology at the University of Michigan and a member of the Tulalip tribes. She studies the psychological effects of stereotypes like school logos and mascots on Native American students.
We exposed Native American high school and college students to American Indian mascots and looked at the effect on self-esteem, community efficacy, and future achievement-related possible selves. And so when exposed to the mascot image relative to being exposed to nothing, what we refer to as a control condition, what we find is that exposure decreases self-esteem, decreases the student's belief that their tribal community can improve itself, so what we refer to as community efficacy. So their confidence that their tribe has the both ability and power to improve itself over time. And it decreases achievement-related possible selves, which are effectively their future goals, achievement-related goals. So they have less future aspirations, achievement-related aspirations in school when exposed to the mascot.
In other words, says Freiberg, the way we see ourselves represented in the society and culture we live in has a huge impact on what we believe is possible for ourselves, our families, and our communities.
You know, one of the things that we have learned across all of our research is that it's really tied to the fact that contemporary Native people are relatively invisible in mainstream society. And this, the use of Indians as mascots is sort of one of the ways in which we are represented. And the problem with it is that it represents us in a very stereotyped way. We all do this. We look out into the world to see how our group is represented, and we use that information to influence whether or not we attempt to take on a particular representation or whether we want to go out and become a doctor or a lawyer. It very much depends on how we are seen in society.
Darius Smith saw this effect on students firsthand when he was the director of Indian education at Denver Public Schools.
And what fascinated me was there wasn't that many American Indians playing high school sports.
This was before Arvada, Arapaho, and Montbello high schools had changed their American Indian mascots.
I was aware of what was happening at Arvada, Arapaho, and Montbello, and I started saying there's a direct correlation with this in terms of the self-esteem of American Indians, but at the same time, the perception of non-natives that they have about American Indians. I would talk to a lot of the high school students who were American Indians in Denver Public Schools and say, why don't you play sports? I don't want to say stereotypes, but often they said, I couldn't beat those fast black guys. I can't beat those big white guys. I started realizing that there was a connection and that maybe I needed to look at, how that imagery was impacting Native people.
The problem, says Freiberg, is that even redesigning respectful mascots and logos with tribal blessings and school support doesn't significantly benefit Native people.
What the research shows, other research that we've done with non-Natives, in particular with whites, shows that keeping these representations boosts their self-esteem and makes them feel good about their group. And so the desire to keep it is very much tied to them and not to Native people. In fact, we see very little in terms of support for keeping Indian mascots. We don't see that connect to support for, say, policies that would help Native people or support for different programs that might benefit Native students. So it's very much...
Here's attorney Lawrence Baca again.
The fact is, you can't assure that in all futures, the only people who will go to the school are members of that tribe who will say, hey, I'm truly honored by this. And quite frankly, while the tribal government is stepping in and helping out, it doesn't necessarily mean that even the tribal members themselves all uniformly agree. And I applaud them for doing it. I applaud the tribe for coming forward and saying, let's help you out. But because underlying it all is still this concept that the Indian child sees that my race is used as a mascot and no other race isn't, has the potential of some very negative long-term effects on their educational process and their psychological well-being.
Dr. Freiberg doesn't dispute the positive outcomes of the relationships built between Strasburg High School students and the Northern Arapaho. She thinks such exchanges should be happening between as many schools and tribes as possible. However,
it should happen regardless of whether or not they're able to use the Indian mascot. And if it were the case that getting rid of that mascot would stop that educational exchange, then it really wasn't premised on the right motivation anyway.
Lawrence Baca is blunt about the consequences.
Unless and until we get rid of stereotypes, Indian people will not be able to escape being trapped in the amber from 200 years ago and come into the modern world as real people. Even though we maintain our culture, as long as we continue to think of Indians as romantic figures out of history, we're not going to give them the rights they deserve today.
Neither Lawrence Baca, Dr. Freiberg, Darius Smith, or Ernest House Jr. believe that the problem of Native American mascots can or should be solved with legislation or legal challenges.
And though tribes giving their blessings to American Indian mascots may not be the ideal outcome in the long run, it's opened the doors to more meaningful change. It'll take more education, more outreach, and more personal connections to help change perceptions about American Indians' past, present, and future.
Darius Smith remembers one such connection after his presentation at Strasburg High School. For him, it was one of the most meaningful moments during his time on the Governor's Commission.
So I think that what was so powerful for me was the enthusiasm, because the kids came up to me afterwards and there was hundreds of them and they wanted to shake my hand and they were like, this is the first time we ever heard a native speak. And then there was one girl in there and she was Navajo, that's my tribe. And I had a necklace on and I put it over her neck and she just looked at me and smiled and everybody just got quiet. And she's all like, and she just stared at me, and Principal Rasp didn't see that. But I left there, I just felt so good. And it was a powerful moment because those students, they were like, yeah, this is wrong.
Lost Highways is a production of History Colorado and History Colorado Studios. It's made possible by a generous grant from the Sturm Family Foundation, with particular thanks to Stephen Sturm and Emily Sturm.
Again, if you enjoyed this podcast and want to support it, please become a member of History Colorado. You can get 20% off your membership at historycolorado.org/podcast discount. Plus, you get all kinds of great benefits like free admission to our 8 museums around the state. And you can see things on exhibit and in our collection that help tell this story, like a Fighting Whitey's t-shirt, a Utah Utes football helmet, and Strasburg High School gear with their new logo.
And even if you don't become a member, you can still get $2 off admission to any of our museums just by mentioning the podcast.
Special thanks to Susan Schulten, our history advisor on this episode, and to Chief Creative Officer Jason Hansen, our editor, and to Connor Bergal, who composed our theme and the music for this season.
And to Morgan Ferris, Program Assistant for the Colorado Commission of Indian Affairs.
Many thanks to our editorial team, Chief Creative Officer Jason Hansen, Sam Bach, Sean Boyd, Brooke Garcia, Steve Grinstead, Kimberly Cronwall, Jose Ortega, Julie Peterson, Angel Vigil, Marisa Volpe, and Zach Workowicz.
And to our advisory group, which includes Stephen Sturm, Emily Sturm, Chief Creative Officer Jason Hansen, Thomas Andrews, Jonathan Futa, Charlie Woolley, Susan Schulten, Tom Romero, and Kara DeGette.
Finally, thanks as always to the entire staff at History Colorado. I'm Noel Black.
And I'm Tyler Hill. Thanks for listening.